Okay, should we get started? See how things work this time. Let me begin by recalling the general plan. I'm trying to first defend a naturalistic approach to problems of language and mind. Second, I want to try to show that the most influential currents of contemporary thought that deal with these issues, primarily philosophy of language and philosophy of mind, but also spilling over to cognitive science, that these approaches are both non-naturalist and radically dualist. And I've tried to show yesterday that those are two different things. You could have naturalist dualism in the Cartesians, but these are dualist and non-naturalist, kind of methodologically dualist. And the third point that I want to make is that all of this is a very serious regression, step backwards, since the 17th century, and it should be completely abandoned without a trace that left, to put it as strongly as possible. Well, this morning I gave some examples of what I think should be called radical methodological dualism with regard to what are, roughly speaking, philosophical issues. Issues having to do with attribution of knowledge, with the propriety of attributing rule following, and so on. The general conclusion, I think the most charitable conclusion that can be drawn, is that in the major thinking about these issues, we have a series of arbitrary stipulations about certain invented disciplines, one of them called linguistics, the other called philosophy. Linguistics is committed, is instructed by these doctrines that if it wants to study Peter's mind, it must consider only Peter's behavior and maybe people in Peter's community, but it's not allowed to study Wang's behavior, and it's not allowed to study, say, cells. Those steps are ruled out, although any scientist would take them at once along lines that were discussed this morning. So if we agree that that's what linguistics is, the response is simple, just abandon it. It's a ridiculous pursuit, and therefore abandon it and turn to this other study in which you're allowed to bring in evidence of whatever sort is relevant to understanding Peter's mind, maybe Wang's mind, maybe things about cells or aphasia or whatever. So the answer to the first stipulation is simple. Let's abandon this ridiculous vocation and turn to a serious topic, which happens to be the topic everybody's pursuing anyway, so it's not a big change. And that takes care of the first point. It's just pointless terminology. With regard to philosophy, philosophy seems to be identified as a discipline that is concerned with something called philosophical explanation, which is different from scientific explanation, and is interested in something called attribution of knowledge and rule following in an invented sense, technical invented sense, namely the sense in which these things turn on access to awareness, access to consciousness. Now, it's possible to invent such a discipline. You can invent anything. That discipline has no connection to inquiry into the nature of the world, telling anything about the world. It has no connection with ordinary usage, which doesn't follow those principles. And as far as I can see, it has no connection with anything. It has a historical tradition. One can see where it got, how it got there. But again, it seems to me a pursuit that has no redeeming virtues, should simply be abandoned. So that's my conclusion about the second one. Well, what I want to do now is continue the discussion, but begin to turn sort of step by step towards cognitive science, not turning now from what are considered philosophical issues, but just seem to be matters of terminological stipulation, turning to substantive issues, more substantive issues, empirical issues. And here, too, there are lots of theories and requirements and so on, so let's continue. One substantive issue, plainly, has to do with the growth of cognitive capacities, the growth and development of cognitive capacities. We know that they change. They're not the same at age, you know, zero as they are at age 12. So some change takes place, some kind of growth, or what's called, in my opinion, rather misleadingly, learning. So say we'll talk about language learning, which I think should be regarded as language growth, analogous to other forms of growth. Well, here we at once run into a kind of dualism of a curious kind. So let's look at it. There's a doctrine that is called innatism. Okay, and there's a big debate about innatism. Now, as in a couple of cases I mentioned yesterday, this debate is one-sided. Lots of people write articles denouncing innatism, but nobody defends it. Nobody writes an article saying, I believe in it. Now, I'm supposed to be the main criminal, you know, the one who is the person who's mainly guilty of the crime of innatism, but I've never really responded to any of the criticisms or defended the doctrine, because I have the slightest idea what the doctrine is supposed to be. Since I don't know what the doctrine is, I can't defend it. I mean, if the doctrine is that humans are different than rocks, then I agree. Humans are different than rocks. Rocks don't learn how to talk. If it's that humans are different than chickens, well, apparently, I mean, chickens don't seem to learn how to talk, and humans don't seem to learn how to fly. Well, if that's innatism, I agree with it. But I don't understand what there is to be defended unless somebody really thinks that rocks do learn to talk. If they don't think that, there doesn't seem to be any doctrine to be discussed, and therefore I don't understand what the arguments are about. Well, interestingly, these arguments are invariably dualistic. That is, they only refer to cognitive growth. They don't refer to embryological development. So to go back to my example of the chicken yesterday, nobody suggests that the transition from an embryo to a chicken is determined by the character of the nutritional environment. It's like if you change the nutritional environment, you might end up with a dog, something like that. Nobody claims that. And the same is true of everything, from sort of conception up to birth. Well, what about after birth? You know, organisms change after birth, too. Well, nobody, I think, believes that children learn to get bigger, say, or to take something that happens pretty far after birth. Take, say, undergoing puberty, which happens at a certain age, roughly. I've never heard anybody suggest that children are taught to undergo puberty. You know, they get instruction from their parents, it's about time, why don't you do it, or something. Or they notice that other people are doing it, say other kids around their age, and they're subject to kind of peer pressure. You know, they want to be like everybody else, so they do it. Nobody has ever suggested that. And so on all the way through all development, except for cognitive development. So the visual cortex assumes whatever structure it does on the basis of internal direction. Now, it's not that anyone knows anything about these topics. Nobody has the slightest idea what makes people undergo puberty at a certain age. And nobody knows, really, what makes a chicken embryo turn into a chicken. Some very strange things happen, and they're hard to explain. I mean, for example, a particular cell, remember, all the cells of the body have the same instructions, but they do different things in different positions. So somehow, a particular cell knows at a certain point that it's got to become a bone, you know, instead of a piece of an eye. And to try to figure out how the cells know that is extremely hard. So it's not that anybody knows the answers. It's just that everyone assumes that it's all determined by some inner program. And the outer environment can have at most very marginal influences. I mean, maybe it can accelerate the development or retard it or something like that, but it can't really change it in any significant fashion. That's just all taken for granted, the absence of any knowledge. And that makes perfect sense, because it's obvious from the qualitative character of the problem. You see in all of these cases that the organism reaches a very complex, highly articulated state of development, and it does it on the basis of extremely limited instructions from the outside, and they all do it about the same way. So if you're even semi-reasonable, you assume it's inner-directed. Well, somehow, in the case of cognitive growth, you're not allowed to be reasonable. The same thing is true there. In fact, in the case of cognitive growth, we even know more about it. So a good deal is known about the innate structure, actually more than in many of these other cases. But we're not, and the qualitative situation is quite the same. You can show quite easily, I mean trivially, that people are capable of interpreting and understanding and freely using without any consciousness of strangeness all kinds of complex constructions that they've never heard, and they've never heard anything like them, and so on and so forth. I mean, that's trivial to demonstrate. A fair amount is known about the initial structure that makes it possible, about the uniformities and so on. Nevertheless, it's considered highly controversial to be reasonable in this domain. And therefore, you have debates about innatism, which means taking the point of view that you take towards a chicken embryo. That's very strange. Again, it's comprehensible on traditional grounds. You know, you can trace it back to traditional religion and, you know, the soul and all sorts of things. But whatever the anthropological explanations or the explanations as a piece of cultural history, it's a view that seems to have no redeeming features. Well, let me... nevertheless, it's very strongly maintained. And again, the most explicit, influential advocate, as in most of these areas because of his enormous influence, is Quine. He's put the point over and over again over the years. Let me take his most recent version, which appears in a book called Pursuit of Truth that just appeared a year or two ago. And I'll actually write this out so we can have a look at it. Let me write it and then I'll... in psychology, one may or may not be a behaviorist. In linguistics, one has no choice. In acquiring language, we depend strictly on observable behavior in observable situations. There is nothing in linguistic meaning. And remember, meaning just means language generally. That just happens to be the aspect of language that the philosophers are interested in. So we could say there is nothing in language beyond what is to be gleaned from overt behavior in observable situations. Accordingly, the behaviorist approach is mandatory. That's the argument. Okay. Now let's try, and that's an argument that's been repeated over and over the years. This is the most recent formulation of it, and it's been very influential. So let's try it below the neck. Okay, let's go back to the chicken. And I'm going to give a paraphrase, an exact paraphrase, in which I'll just change a couple of words. In the passage from the embryo to the mature state, the embryo depends strictly on nutrition from outside. There is nothing in the structure of the mature organism beyond what is to be gleaned from nutritional inputs. Okay. Therefore, accordingly, the nutritionist approach is mandatory. Biologists must be nutritionists. Okay. Notice that's exactly the same argument. All I've done is replace, you know, nutritional observable situations by nutritional inputs. But the argument's the same. And the conclusion, therefore, is that embryologists should abandon all of this complicated inquiry into how a cell decides to become a bone in one place and an eye somewhere else, and they should really do something much simpler. Just take a look at the nutritional inputs to the embryo, which is going to be really easy because they're about the same for a chicken and a frog and everything else. And if you look at them, that's all there is. That's going to tell you everything. Well, there's got to be something wrong with that argument. I mean, if anybody presented that argument in embryology, people wouldn't even bother laughing. Why? I mean, why is it any more sensible in the study of language than it is in the study of embryology? That's the question that ought to be asked. Now, notice that it's not that the argument is wrong. The argument is, in fact, entirely correct. It's perfectly true that we depend completely on observable observable behavior and observable situations, and it's equally true that the embryo depends on nutritional inputs only. There isn't anything else, so that's what it depends on. But the question, of course, is what does the word depend mean? You know, what does the organism do with the, how do you spell out dependence? You know, let's spell out the concept dependence. Well, when you spell out the concept dependence in embryology, you get these complex theories about how cells, you know, depending on the gradient of certain chemical concentrations, know that they're supposed to produce this protein and not that protein. And then after all kind of complicated stuff, you end up with a chicken. Spelling that out is the meaning of dependence. But of course, the same problem is going to arise in language. You've got to spell out the notion of dependence. Well, there is a theory that spells it out. That's the theory of basically universal grammar. It's the theory I talked about before, which says there's some sort of a device, which is the internal structure of the language faculty, and it has all these internal parts and properties and so on and so forth. And when it gets observable behavior, what I call data, it spins its wheels in the way which linguists try to describe, and it ends up giving you the I language. And this is the dependence. That's the spelling out of the notion depend. Now, in embryology, you're allowed to do it. In linguistics, you're not. And linguistics means... Now, it's interesting that in this case, he distinguishes psychology from linguistics. In earlier writings, psychologists had to be behaviorists too. And that's connected with the move that I mentioned this morning, which distinguishes psychological evidence from linguistic evidence. And psychological evidence has this miraculous character that it enables you to do what scientists do, but linguistic evidence somehow doesn't. I think that this is just pushing the dualism deeper. You know, when you're looking at things like vision, say, you're not getting really close to the soul yet. So therefore, you can allow science to enter. But when you get to language, you know, you're right at the core of things. Here we have to make sure the barriers are very high and nothing rational is going to be allowed. Now, I don't want to suggest that Quine is, is religious or anything. In fact, he's a total atheist. He thinks the whole business is nonsense. And he thinks the only thing that exists in the world is elementary particles. Nevertheless, when he deals with the questions, it sort of spells itself out as something very similar to the traditional church. Now that's an interesting phenomenon, because what it means, it's an interesting phenomenon about our intellectual culture. The most naturalistic, hard-headed, scientific people, as they begin to think about things that are close to what traditionally was the seat of the soul, you know, they veer away from rationality. I mean, it's like a particle being repelled by a particle of the same charge. You can sort of start getting close to it, but as you get closer and closer, you move away. And that's a very common feature of the intellectual culture. And it's quite remarkable to see how it shows up even among the most hard-headed, most scientific people. It's definitely worth thinking about for those who are interested in our intellectual culture. Now, the point is, without properties in the internal state, nothing is going to happen when you're given the nutritional inputs or the observable behavior. There has to be some structure to the organism, otherwise it's not going to do anything to the inputs. You give the nutritional inputs to a rock, it's not going to become a chicken. And you give the nutritional inputs to a rock and it won't pick up an eye language. The reason is because something about the internal structure of the embryo and the internal structure of the human brain. Now, Quine, of course, doesn't deny this. In fact, he agrees with it and insists on it. And he even tells us what the internal structure must be. So he definitely rejects the theory that I described, the one that's guilty of innatism. But he has his own theory about what's in here. Okay, he tells you what it is, what capacities the child is allowed to have. And the capacities are those that are spelled out in what is called his radical translation paradigm, a kind of thought experiment. And if you look at it, the child is allowed to identify objects. The child is granted all of phonology. It's kind of an interesting fact. because it's not clear why. But somehow the child is granted all of phonology, so it gets words and phonological representations. It's even granted morphology, so it gets sentences broken up into words. After it gets expressions, like words, which it gets somehow, there's something in here that allows that, the child is allowed to ask, do the equivalent of asking a question to see whether people assent or dissent. When they're shown a certain stimulus and given a certain word. Okay. So you got a stimulus over here, hear a word, and you're allowed to ask your teacher, is this stimulus a so-and-so or isn't it a stimulus, a so-and-so? The case that Quine discusses famously is where you see a rabbit and the word gavagai, and the child is allowed to say that, yeah, that stimulus is or is not a gavagai. Okay, that's all. Then you're allowed elementary induction. Elementary induction is sort of if things work some of the time, they probably work all the time, something like that. If you look more closely, the child is also allowed a quality space. So that's a set of properties, like, say, color, loudness, things like that. It's not really specified, but you're allowed some kind of quality space, and you're allowed a distance measure. So you're allowed to say two things are closer in color, A is closer in color to B than it is to C. Actually, I cheated a little here when I said you see a rabbit, because, of course, all you see is some visual presentation. Okay, and in fact, the core of Quine's theory is there's no way for the child to know whether that visual stimulation is a rabbit or, the tail of a rabbit, or a rabbit against the background of a bush, or a stage in the growth of rabbits, or whatever. Anything that's consistent with the stimulation is given by the assent relation here. Okay, and from that, that's radical translation. That's the whole story. And that's the structure of the organism. So, of course, Quine has a theory of the structure of the organism. He's not saying it's a blank slate. That would be absurd. Because he recognizes, in fact, that would be absurd. But notice we've just gone from one absurdity to another. This is a theory of the organism, and it's an empirical theory, right? It's got to be treated like any other empirical theory. And the theory is so ridiculous, it isn't even worth looking at. We know for certain that nothing like that is the structure of the organism. And there isn't any reason whatsoever to take that theory seriously. There isn't a particle of evidence that that's what people are like. And insofar as we know anything about them, they're not like that. So therefore, the theory is not worth looking at. The theory is presented purely a priori. No evidence is given for it. There's no indication of how you might proceed to find evidence for it. It's just stipulated. This is the theory. This is what organisms are allowed to have above the neck. I mean, even if by some miracle it turned out to be true, it would be a totally irrational step. In other fields, you're not allowed to just stipulate a priori what the structure of some system is, because that's what it looks like, and that's what you like, or something. You're not allowed to do that. If someone came along and stipulated the structure of a chicken embryo, even if by a miracle they turned out to be right, people wouldn't pay any attention to it. If you propose a theory, you need some arguments. You need some evidence. You have to say, why is it this and why not something else? So, in fact, this is just the purest form of irrationality. It's true that there is a structure to the organism, but there isn't the slightest reason to believe that that structure has anything to do with the organism. And in fact, when you try to apply that structure, you get into all sorts of crazy conclusions. You find that you cannot possibly explain what people in fact know. I mean, what people in fact know isn't accounted for at all by this. We have overwhelming evidence about what they know. For example, in the case of gavagai, we say rabbit or whatever the equivalent word is in Catalan or anything else, we know perfectly well that children immediately, actually on one presentation, you don't even need a lot of evidence, take the word, and they don't ask assent-dissent questions. They just hear somebody use the word in some circumstance, and they instantly know, virtually without error or without later correction, that what was meant was a particular animal. You know, not that animal along with a twig that was next to it, and not a stage of the animal, and so on and so forth. Now, we have evidence strong. We can accumulate evidence as strong as you like that that happened. Furthermore, if that were not what happened, nobody would even understand Quine's discussion. I mean, if half the people in the world had thought that rabbit means rabbit stage, and the other half thought that rabbit means rabbit, how would the first half even understand his example? I mean, the fact is everybody understands the example because we all made the same move. We all picked out rabbit as soon as we heard the relevant word applying. And furthermore, a fair amount is known about how this happens, about what kinds of entities are picked out, pre-linguistically even, what kinds of object constancy there are, you know, how children, pre-linguistic children, identify stimuli as three-dimensional and persistent, like remaining after they disappear behind the screen and coming out in the right place. They get surprised if it comes out in the wrong place and that sort of thing. And there's all kinds of understanding of how children conceive of the world even before they start learning language. And of course, when they start learning language, it relates to the way they've already conceived of the world. And as we go on, we find more and more respects in which nothing of the sort even happens. So we have a stipulation which is completely false, completely easily refutable, and not worth looking at in the first place because it's totally arbitrary. So why does anybody pay attention to it? Why is there an influential tradition, including most of serious analytic philosophy until today, which looks at the consequences of the radical translation paradigm? Now, the radical translation paradigm yields a property that Quine calls indeterminacy, indeterminacy of translation. The problem is that if you're only allowed this much structure, then it's true that the child can't tell whether the stimulus was meant to be a rabbit or a stage of a rabbit or whatever. So therefore, the answer is indeterminate, and Quine therefore concludes there's no truth to the matter. There's no, the question, does gavagai mean an actual animal, or does it mean an actual animal with a twig behind it? That's not a question that has a truth value. There's no truth to the question of whether it's one or the other. It's indeterminate, and indeterminacy is to be distinguished from underdetermination, crucially. Like everybody, Quine recognizes that in the sciences, everything is underdetermined. So if you draw a conclusion in the sciences, say, you know, relativity theory, it's, of course, underdetermined by the evidence. There was plenty of, there were, in fact, infinitely many possible theories alternative to that one that were consistent with all the evidence around. That's the state of rational inquiry. State of rational inquiry is it's always underdetermined. That's what it means for something to be empirical inquiry. If it's not underdetermined, it's mathematics, not empirical. The only place where inquiry is not underdetermined is where you stipulate in advance what the answer is, and then it's mathematics. If it's an effort to find out about the world, everything you do is underdetermined. But this problem here is supposed to be something beyond underdetermination, something really lethal, indeterminacy, something which crucially affects language and meaning and reference and so on. And all sorts of conclusions are then drawn about language and thinking and people and so on and so forth. And we're simply told that we're not allowed to consider an alternative theory of the initial state, namely one that works and has scientific evidence supporting it. We're not allowed to take that one. We have to take this one, which is a priori and instantly refuted. Well, that's extremely strange. And how strange it is, you see, if you look more closely even into the radical translation paradigm. I mentioned that the child, incidentally, the way this is usually described is in terms of a linguist, not a child. And remember, the principle is that the linguist has to follow the path of the child. The child depends only on observable inputs, therefore the linguist has to depend only on observable inputs. Well, that's kind of strange to start with. I mean, the embryologist doesn't have to follow the path of the chicken. Okay, like if an embryologist is studying a chicken, it doesn't just take in nutritional inputs and sort of, you know, drink the milk or something like that. The embryologist is allowed to do all sorts of other things, but the linguist isn't. The linguist has to follow the path of the child. A hopelessly irrational idea, if you think about it, but one which is incidentally never questioned in the field. Take a look at the literature. This has been around for 40 years. There's nobody who's questioned it internally. It's questioned sort of from the periphery all the time, but nobody pays any attention to that. Professional disciplines are very well insulated. That's one of the differences between the sciences and the humanities. Striking difference. In the sciences, you just can't be irrational, because if you are, you're refuted at once and nobody cares about you anymore. But in the humanities, you can be as irrational as you like, because the disciplines are insulated and they don't really have strong empirical evidence bearing on them. You can go on for craziness forever, and it happens all the time. It's sort of typical. That's another fact about intellectual history, if you like. I mean, it's not that scientists have better genes or anything. It's just that nature is, you know, tough, doesn't let you get away with nonsense. If you try faking an experiment or, you know, making up a priori theory, people will refute it, and then you're finished. You know. Furthermore, in the sciences, you can't keep doing the same thing over and over for the rest of your life. Your students will start asking questions, and they'll say, why don't you do this? And pretty soon they'll be off learning new things, and you'll be out of the business. In the humanities, that's not true. These are really big differences. Other kinds of dualism, which are, if you like, part of cultural history, actually it's very striking personally to me where I live. I live right, well, a lot of you have been around, you know what it's like. There are two major universities, maybe the two world's major universities within, you know, a mile. One of them is Harvard, which is humanities-based. I mean, it has sciences, but, you know, the spirit of the place is determined by the humanities. The oligarchy that runs it comes from the humanities and so on. The other is MIT, which is a science university. I mean, it has some humanities, but they're kind of, you know, around the periphery. And the difference of intellectual character between the two places is just astonishing. I mean, I've been there for 40 years, going up and back between them. And it's like two totally different worlds, you know, in every area. That's why linguistics is at MIT, not at Harvard. And it's, in fact, if you look around the world, it's mostly developed in places where there are no strong humanistic traditions. It hasn't developed in the major universities that have humanities programs. That's true in the United States, it's true in Europe, it's true in Japan, and it reflects something very obvious. In the humanities, disciplines are insulated. They don't want to change. They don't want to hear. They want students to come along with challenging questions. They want to keep repeating the same thing forever. There's a lot of personal power involved you can get away with. You're never going to be refuted. You can tell lies about the French Revolution forever, and you'll never be refuted. And the effect is that when new things come along, they're welcomed in the sciences. People want them. You know, you want things to be shaken up because you want to learn something new. But in the humanities, it's frightening. And therefore, they're sort of pushed aside. I don't want to say this is 100%, but the tendencies are very striking. Let's take a look at the radical translation experiment. Let's agree to what is completely irrational, namely that the linguist has to follow the path of the child. Okay, so I described it as something that the child does. Now we have the linguist coming in to study the community from the outside. Okay, so here's this jungle community, as Quine calls it. It's off somewhere. The linguist comes from the outside. The linguist is trying to figure out what language they speak. Now, if the linguist was a scientist, what he would do is just what he would do if he was trying to figure out what bird there is in this jungle. The linguist would bring along as part of the baggage everything that he or she knows about language. Then you do all sorts of things about language, you know, from studying other languages, and, you know, psychology, whatever. You have a huge amount of understanding about language, and any linguist who went to study this would bring along that information, just as any, you know, ornithologist studying birds would do it. The linguist would see right off that these things over here are people, just like other people, meaning they're not genetically designed to pick up this language rather than another one, so therefore they fall within the human species, and therefore whatever is true of Chinese and Japanese and Catalan and Swahili and so on is going to be true of these people, so you bring all that along. But the radical translation linguist is not allowed to do this. And that's part of the question I discussed this morning of using information about Wang to draw conclusions about Peter. You're not allowed to do it. You're only allowed to look at Peter's behavior. And notice that that's true of the child. The child, when the child's trying to pick up its language, it doesn't bring along information about Swahili, because it doesn't know anything about Swahili. But remember, the child has all of that built in. Doesn't have to bring it along. The child has all of that information stored in his brain. The linguist is trying to find out what the child has stored in his brain. The child doesn't have to bother finding out. It already knows it. So that's why, it's really wrong to say that the child doesn't bring along information about Swahili. It does, because the child has universal grammar. Just as the chicken embryo brings along information about every mature chicken, because it's got it stored in its genes. And the same is true of the child. Well, let's take a look at the linguist pursuing this curious path, not allowed to use anything that has been learned about language, not allowed to use anything that might be learned about, say, cellular biology or the structure of the brain or whatever, not allowed to have what the child has, crucially, namely universal grammar stored into its head, because the linguist doesn't, the linguist has it as something it can use, but it doesn't have it as something it can study. Like the embryologist has genetic instructions, not unlike those in the chicken, in fact, but those genetic instructions don't help it in studying a chicken. I mean, a human arm is like a chicken's arm. It has one big bone and two small bones, and happens at five instead of three, but that's a trivial difference. Then basically three digits. That's just like a chicken's arm. So the human embryologist has stored in its genes the answer to the question of how the chicken did what it did, but that doesn't help, because the embryologist is approaching the chicken with its science-forming capacities, not with its gene instructions. In fact, it's trying to find out what the instructions are in the gene. And the same is true of the linguist. The linguist has universal grammar in the genes, but that doesn't help study universal grammar, for the same reason. Well, all right, now we have this linguist curiously handicapped, not allowed to know what has been learned about language, not allowed to use information about the initial state that's been discovered or that's stored or whatever, restricted to observable behavior and observable situations, but of course lacking what the child had, namely the internal structure that made it possible to get something out of that. Well, what is the linguist supposed to do? The linguist now sees this stimulus. It's supposed to hear the word kavagai, and then the linguist is allowed to ask the informants, is that thing a gavagai or isn't it? It gets a yes or no answer. Then the linguist is allowed to do simple induction, and you end up with indeterminacy. Okay, that's the same course. But now notice what's been presupposed. The linguist was allowed to hear the word gavagai. What does that mean? I mean, all the linguist heard was some signal, some noise. The linguist heard a noise, saw a visual stimulus. How's the linguist get from the noise to gavagai? Well, as any phonologist, any linguist knows, that's a tough job. Getting from a noise to gavagai involves a lot of theoretical assumption. For example, you have to ask, see, this is some kind of phonological representation, quite abstract representation. I mean, for example, you have to know, is that the same noise as something you might transcribe, I don't know, say, kepeki, say, suppose that comes along next. Is it the same noise or a different noise? Well, you don't know. I mean, depends on your phonological theory. Could be a repetition of the same word. For example, this could be a language which neutralizes voicing and neutralizes front and back vowels and has what amounts to the English vowel shift as an option. Okay, those are all sort of intelligible phonological processes. Maybe that's in part of the optional phonology of this language, so these are the same word. Well, somehow, Quine's linguist has gotten over that stage. He's allowed all the kinds of scientific inquiry that tell you that these are different words, or maybe the same word. All of that's presupposed in setting up the radical translation experiment where you're granted that you hear gavagai. And that's an awful lot. It's not trivial. There's an awful lot of linguistic theory presupposed, granted to the linguist as more equipment. Now, why? Now, of course, you get all the same indeterminacy problems there. I mean, hearing the signal, the conclusion that it was Gagagai, no, not some other thing, is exactly as indeterminate as concluding that it was rabbit, not rabbit state. In fact, that's putting it unfairly. We have a lot more evidence here that the child is going to pick rabbit than we do that it's going to pick Gagagai from a signal. In fact, it might have picked different things here. For example, it might be the case that the child picked out something that doesn't distinguish these two. You know, I picked a pretty wild example, but you can take less wild examples where in existing phonological theory would just say, hearing a signal, you could have picked this range, you could have picked this range. And in fact, that's permitted by phonological theory. However, nothing is permitted by the theory of conceptual development. Here we have very strong evidence that everyone picks out rabbit, not rabbit stage. It's not that there's some communities where they pick out rabbit and there are others that they pick out rabbit stage. In fact, all that was picked out before the child ever heard any language. In fact, maybe built in to start with before any experience, for all we know. So looking at the question naturalistically, we've granted exactly the wrong talents to the linguist. We have not granted the linguist the ability to solve this indeterminacy, although it is solved in the world. And we have granted the linguist the ability to solve this indeterminacy, though in fact it really is indeterminate. Not totally indeterminate. There is a theory which will ultimately resolve it. But on presentation of a single signal, you don't know. When you hear the first signal, you don't know whether it's been this range or this range. So that's real underdetermination. And there's a science that explains it and deals with it and tells how you converge from one answer or another. Here there's no underdetermination at all, as far as we know. So to conclude that here we have a problem of indeterminacy and here we don't is very curious, very curious indeed. Well, why is the linguist allowed to do that? And why is he automatically granted all the theory that lets you get as far as Gagagai? Well, I think the answer, there's no rational answer. But again, there's an answer that comes out of intellectual history. Gagagai has to do with sounds, with the perceptual articulatory system. And the perceptual articulatory system is far enough away from the soul so that you're allowed to be rational. But, you know, the concept rabbit somehow is closer to the soul. So we've got that same problem of the particle being repelled as it gets closer to the question. As you get closer to it, you have to veer off into more and more irrationality. I don't think there's any other explanation for this. If you think this is wrong, try to work one out. Try to work out another explanation for why everyone's happy by saying there's no underdetermination in the case where there really is underdetermination, namely the phonology. And there is underdetermination in the case where there really isn't underdetermination, namely the concepts. Why is everybody happy with that? And why is it the basis for, you know, huge theories about humans and so on and so forth? Well, as I say, there is a reasonable theory, wherever it was. Probably erased it somewhere. You know, that one up there. That tries to deal with all of these questions, and both the Gagagai-type question and the concept-type question, and does so with, you know, reasonable success with the kinds of problems that arise in empirical inquiry. We're told by the anti-innatists that theory has to be abandoned, not because it's false. You know, they don't provide any evidence against it. It's just you're not allowed to do it, period. Philosopher stipulates that you're not allowed to do it. Philosopher stipulates that you have to pick this theory, although we know it to be false, and it was totally arbitrary. And the assumptions that it makes are completely irrational. That's where that debate lies. Now, perhaps what seems to be the right theory ought to be abandoned. In fact, very likely it ought to be. You know, chances that we've hit the right theory are very slight. You know? So probably it'll be abandoned. Well, probably 10 years from now, somebody will have a better theory. That's what we expect. But to show that it ought to be abandoned in terms of something unknown, it does not suffice to require that the linguist abandon naturalistic inquiry. That's not a good enough argument. It's not enough to say you have to abandon the methods of the sciences and you have to accept arbitrary stipulations that I make up. That's not a strong enough argument. In fact, it's no argument. And I stress again that nothing comparable would ever be considered for an instant in the study of other aspects of growth, say a chicken embryo, or for that matter, even phonetics. I mean, if somebody were to come along with similar stipulations in, the sound side of language, even the philosophers would laugh. But when you get to the conceptual side or the structural side, it's taken very seriously. Well, again, that seems to be a radical form of anti-naturalist dualism. As far as I can see, let me put it in the strongest possible terms, nothing can be resurrected from this highly influential picture. It's kind of a paradigm example of what ought to be avoided in philosophy or the sciences or anything else. I'm trying to put the conclusion as strongly as possible in the hope that it will sound as outrageous as possible and lead you to think about whether what I just said is wrong, and if so, why, and if it's right, what it means. Well, let's turn to another issue. We're now dealing with substantive issues, namely language growth. And I'm trying to argue that the irrationality pervades the substantive issues just as much as it pervades the so-called philosophical issues about attribution of knowledge and so on. Let's take another kind of substantive issue. A question that came up yesterday, in fact, in the discussion, the question of reductionism. Okay. So natural inquiry leads to all kinds of hypotheses about the brain of the kind that I roughly sketched out. For example, it leads to phonological theories that tell you what the possible regions are within which that signal could be placed and how you could proceed to decide what's the right region. It leads to theories that give you, you know, the binding theory facts that I spoke about this morning that deal with referential dependency and so on. And it deals with phrase structure, another example that came up, and all kind of other things. It does it by attributing to the brain certain states and certain properties, certain architecture, well-understood properties, like being a generative procedure, which in fact can be spelled out quite carefully. However, this is regarded as highly controversial and maybe absurd. The reason is that nobody knows how to relate these states and properties to other kinds of description of the brain, say description of the brain in terms of cells. That's largely true. Incidentally, it's not entirely true. A couple of examples have already come up to indicate where it's not true. So there are some things about localization that are known, which are not trivial. For example, as I mentioned yesterday, that localization of the syntactic and semantic processing for sign language appears to be in the same place as where it is for spoken language, which is a very remarkable fact, because it's in the left hemisphere, the language hemisphere, whereas visual processing must go on in sign language is typically in the right hemisphere. So there's something deep about syntactic and semantic processing which is localized in the left hemisphere, no matter what the modality is. Luigi mentioned this morning some other things. Results by Karamazza on differences between inflectional and derivational morphology associated with particular kinds of localizable brain injury. There are other examples, some of them kind of striking. Let's have a look at one. This one has to do with some recent studies just recently published on what are called ERPs, that stands for event-related potentials. Doesn't matter what they are. It's just some measure of electrical activity of the brain. Okay. It turns out that when people are doing different things, you know, thinking different thoughts or saying different things and so on, the brain is always producing tons of electrical activity, and you can measure it now. There's sophisticated techniques for measuring it, for extracting signals from noise and so on. And it turns out kind of remarkably that you can find quite distinctive patterns associated with particular properties of thought and language. So for example, it's been known for some time that what are called semantically deviant sentences, you know, things like colorless green ideas sleep furiously, that kind, or I ate the house or something like that. When people hear those sentences, the brain produces a specific characteristic, a electrical pattern, which is like a mark that some semantic confusion took place. Notice that that fact alone would suffice to tell us, suggest to us, that the semantic indeterminacy theories are way off the mark. I mean, our notion of semantic coherence is tight that deviation from it even sets off identifiable brain, potential electrical activity of the brain, which is distinctive, a particular pattern that identifies semantic deviance. Well, some more recent work has gone on to find distinctive ERP patterns for several categories of linguistic expressions, which are quite intriguing. For example, it turns out that non-deviant sentences, things like John took a walk in the garden or something, sentences that are semantically deviant. So, John took a flower, some crazy word instead of walk in the garden. Phrase structure deviances, where you break phrase structure rules. extraction violations of two types. One, extraction from specific noun phrases. It's well known that if you have a sentence like, who did you see? A picture of, this is English now, but there are comparable things in other languages. Who did you see a picture of is an okay sentence. But if you try, who did you see that picture of, it's not any good anymore. Something goes wrong. Okay. And the reason has to do with the fact that that picture of him is specific in reference, picks out something particular. A picture of him is non-specific. And it's a very subtle point, because in fact if you take indefinite noun phrases and you give them a specific interpretation, you get the same violation. So that's one kind of deviance. There's another kind of deviance that's, its technical term is subjacency. And it basically means moving something farther than it ought to move. So sentences like, who did you wonder whether John met are worse than, they sound worse to people than, who did you think that John met? The well-known difference. Now, it turns out that these five categories of expressions, non-deviant, semantically deviant, violation of phrase structure rules, violations of extraction from specific noun phrases, subjacency violations, moving something too far, yield distinctive patterns of electrical activity of the brain. Each category yields its own pattern. Okay, so all subjacency violations yield the same pattern. All extraction from specific violations yield the same pattern. That's quite a surprising result in many ways. In fact, it's results that linguists could use to sharpen up their own experiments, because a lot of these judgments are pretty subtle and not terribly reliable. And, they change under all kind of slight changes of the conditions when you change from a finite clause to an infinitive clause. And there's a lot of work on it, and it's by no means settled what's going on there. But you do get distinctive brain patterns, distinctive ERP patterns. Well, remember, our question was a question of reductionism. That's really the wrong way to put it. It's a question of unification. We have a characterization of the brain in terms of computational representational systems, which leads to certain results and explanations and understanding. We have another account of the brain in terms of electrical activity, and here we're beginning to find correlations. We're beginning to find relations between the two. Well, that's always exciting, but think through what these relations mean. It's very much like the case of clique displacement that I discussed this morning. These five categories of expressions are well established within the computational representational theories. They have a theoretical home. The categories are picked out because of properties of the theories. There's evidence about them from lots of different languages. They're embedded in theoretical understanding. Therefore, they're significant, and there's all kinds of evidence bearing on them. The ERP results are just curiosities. I mean, it happens that the people studying the brain, who are, of course, guided by these categories, they can pick sentences at random, the people who were studied it included linguists, like Andy Barsh, who a lot of you know, who knew what to look for. And they found numbers. But apart from the correlation, the numbers are just curiosities. There is no theory of electrical activity of the brain that tells you why these numbers should have any significance. You get all kinds of numbers. These happen to have significance because they correlate with the better understood computational representational theories. So you have a kind of unification, but it's unification from the weak theory to the strong theory. That is, and now we know something about electrical activity of the brain. Namely, it seems to correlate with things that really exist, namely these categories. I stress this because the standard dualist reaction to this information is going to be the opposite. The standard dualist reaction is going to be, okay, we've now given some support to the linguist's categories because of the ERP results, just as click experiments were misinterpreted that way. But that's complete nonsense. The ERP results are totally meaningless, apart from the fact that they correlate with the linguist's results.